yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has four causes on its oral submission docket. In the order in which we will hear them, they are as follows. National Medical Enterprises, Incorporated, and Psychiatric Institutes of America, Incorporated, and now known as NME Psychiatric Hospitals, Incorporated, and Ron Cronin versus the Honorable David C. Godby, Judge, an original mandamus proceeding. Heritage Resources, Incorporated versus Nation Bank, co-trustee under the will of David B. Trammell, deceased, and others from Winkler County. San Antonio Independent School District and others versus Charles McKinney from Bexar County. And Maritime Overseas Corporation and Trans Bulk Carriers Incorporated versus Thomas C. Waiters from Harris County. The court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. Relators or petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by so advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and will conclude these oral arguments before we take our lunch break for the day. The court is pleased to welcome Judge Greg Abbott from the 129th District Court in Houston, who is with us today and who will be assuming this bench the first of next year. These arguments are being recorded for the court's convenience. If you desire to purchase a tape of the arguments, you may talk to the clerk of our court. We are ready to hear arguments from relators in NME versus Godby.
May it please the court, Mr. Barry McNeil will present arguments for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm here today on behalf of the NME related defendant and on behalf of Ron Cronin. Mr. Mike Carnes, counsel for Ron Cronin, is in the audience today. And Mr. Cronin, Mr. Carnes, and I have agreed that the entire presentation will be made by me. Your Honors, the principle of law at stake in this proceeding today is whether a law firm that obtains the most sensitive and confidential information imaginable from both a client and that client's employer in the midst of a joint defense agreement, whether that law firm may later forsake that client and that employer and that party to that joint defense agreement and prosecute a lawsuit that necessarily imperils the civil and the criminal rights of the client and the civil rights of the company. And the answer to that is no for two reasons. The first reason is that under Rule 109A of our disciplinary rules, a lawyer may not handle a substantially similar representation that's adverse to a former client. And in this instance, it was absolutely clear that the two representations are substantially similar, and indeed they're identical. Where the trial court erred with respect to adversity, with respect to Ron Cronin, is in finding that there was no adversity, and that's wrong as a matter of law. The second reason, Your Honors, why disqualification is proper as a matter of law is that in any joint defense arrangement, when confidences are shared, a fiduciary duty arises. And that duty goes further than simply having a recitation on the part of the party that received those confidences, that they will hold those confidences and not share those with other members of their law firm who are taking actions adverse. In short, the rule of law that we are proposing today and we think is well formulated is that once a lawyer undertakes to defend the specified conduct, he cannot later turn around and prosecute that very same conduct armed with the confidences received during the original representation. And that's particularly true, we believe, whereas here the criminal proceeding that surrounds Ron Cronin is overwhelming.
What criminal proceeding specifically is Mr. Cronin likely or possibly to be subjected to?
Mr. Cronin is in the middle of one of the largest criminal investigations, and I'm not exaggerating, in the history of our United States government. The Department of Justice, U.S. Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Texas, a variety of other U.S. attorneys throughout the country are investigating the conduct of managers, and officers, and independent contractors of the psychiatric division of NME Inc. That investigation started, as best we know, back around 1992. And from that time until the very moment that I speak, Your Honor, Mr. Ron Cronin is right in the middle of that.
You say he's in the middle. What objective indicia are there that to indicate that he might be a target of a criminal investigation?
His lawyer, Mike Carnes, has so testified. He himself, Mr. Cronin, in his testimony in this matter, said that when he and Mr. Tomko, the lawyer, of course, with Baker Botts, when he and Mr. Tomko met with federal agents and lawyers, it was made clear to him that he would be prosecuted for criminal conduct. So I don't think there is any question but that Ron Cronin faces the specter of criminal conduct. Whether he has been nominated a target or not is absolutely meaningless if one understands the criminal law process. His position alone, Your Honor, as head of the Texas region of PIA, as evidenced by that chart, puts him right in the middle of criminal proceedings. And if I may add one point to that, Peter Alexis, his predecessor as the individual in charge of the Texas region, has been indicted and has pled and has been sentenced to federal criminal charges with respect to his role as the administrator of the Texas region.
Mr. McNeil, the basis, I'm a little bit confused here. Are you saying that to get where you want to go, which is the disqualification of the lawyers that the plaintiffs have chosen to represent them, your opponent, to get there, we have to give a broad reading to adverse to Mr. Cronin, the language adverse, does adverse literally mean that any issue that could possibly be considered in the realm of thinking be adverse to a former client, that former client can argue that this lawyer cannot get involved in some other litigation in which he's not involved? In other words, does the adverse include the whole panoply of possibilities, or does adverse, how does it affect you?
The answer to your question is absolutely not. Adversity does not involve a large spectrum. Adversity under the circumstances of this case are very narrow and tightly confined. There can be no question in our view. The rule of law that we're promoting is not a rule of law that would define adversity fraud. The rule of law that we're promoting, and we think is implicit in the rules, is that in any instance where a law firm takes a position that is directly, immediately, palpably harmful to its client, then that law firm is, under any state, adverse to its client.
Okay, this is not, Cronin is not their client.
Well, the former client, Your Honor, under 109.
Okay, your former client.
Yes, under 109, of course, the former client has the right to seek disqualification if the matter is substantially related and if the law firm is now adverse. And as you know, adversity is not defined under 109. Adversity is defined under 106.
What has it done that is presently threatening to Mr. Cronin as opposed to potentially?
Your Honor, the mere filing of this lawsuit in the beginning of the discovery process places Mr. Cronin's rights in peril. Mr. Cronin has been named in other lawsuits. Mr. Cronin has been named in other lawsuits since this lawsuit was filed.
It seems like in the former matter in which Baker and Botts was retained, they might well have taken the position that NME was guilty or liable for all it was accused of, and Mr. Cronin was not. And that's really not any different from the position they're taking now.
Well, to the extent that they're suggesting because Mr. Cronin earlier proclaimed his innocence and because Mr. Tomko on his behalf proclaimed his innocence, somehow excuses them from taking this action is to me, without meaning any disrespect, specious, Your Honor.
But the point of getting outside counsel is so that that can come up.
The point of getting outside counsel is to ensure that the Cronins of the world are adequately and completely represented. And when that lawyer chooses to forsake that representation and move on and file a lawsuit such as the lawsuit that's been filed here, which, if I may, accuses and names NME, all of the entities to which Mr. Cronin reported, all of the entities that reported to Mr. Cronin, and a lawsuit on behalf of patients designated in yellow, this lower block were all of the patients, Your Honors, that have filed this lawsuit. The yellow designate those patients that were patients in the facilities at the time Mr. Cronin was regional director. In other words, the CIA, the CEO of the Texas region. This lawsuit, and let's make no mistake about it, this lawsuit is not narrowly confined. This lawsuit charges top to bottom fraud on the part of NME. It says that over a period of time, NME, through its psychiatric division, through its various hospitals that treated patients, that organization, through its managers and through its officers, defrauded patients. They defrauded them in the admission process, in the treatment process, and in the discharge process. They say that Mr. Alexis was a part of that, the immediate predecessor to Mr. Cronin. They named everyone around Mr. Cronin. They say that the conduct was broad and corrupt, again, from top to bottom. Their lawsuit is an indictment, if you will, Your Honor, of that institution.
But wouldn't they have taken the same position if they had to when they were representing him early, when NME first got him outside counsel?
Well,
if it looked like to them that the best way to represent him was to tell what everybody else was doing, then that's what they would have done.
Absolutely. And they had every right to do that. They chose not to do that. They chose to proclaim his innocence. And I suppose that the concern I have about the position that they're taking now, and to get back to that question, Your Honor, is that because Mr. Cronin, through his lawyer, Mr. Tomko, proclaimed his innocence at an earlier point, does that somehow free this lawsuit to now attempt to impeach that, to discredit that, to make him out to be a liar? And that's what this lawsuit does.
So can't they prosecute this whole case and insist that Cronin is the one angel in the group?
Could they do that? I suppose they could do that if they wish to do that, but how in the world could you ever prove wrongdoing with respect to the policies and practices of hospitals at this level if the person in charge of it was pure as the driven snow? And if the person that preceded him was dirty?
Well, isn't that an argument that they may be breaching some sort of duty to their plaintiff clients as opposed to breaching some sort of duty to Cronin? I mean, isn't that an argument for saying, well, they can't prove without Cronin, so wouldn't the person who ought to be coming forward is the plaintiffs who hired him, saying, how come you're not suing Cronin, as opposed to the defendant saying, how come you're not suing your former client?
Well, it certainly might. I'm not privy to the relationship, of course, with their current client, and I don't know what their current clients think about any of this. I can tell you that their current clients did not choose the law firm of Baker Botts. The current client chose a lawyer who associated Baker Botts at some later point. I don't say that disparagingly. I'm saying that it's a fact that we should not be concerned about whether these plaintiffs had their choice of counsel, because these plaintiffs chose a law firm that then associated Baker Botts.
You said a moment ago in your argument that your client was being palpably harmed. Can you give us more specifics on how you believe that your client is being palpably harmed today?
And my client now is NME.
Excuse me, answer Mr. Cronin.
Mr. Cronin. Mr. Cronin has just recently been named in additional civil actions by patients throughout the state of Texas. Those lawsuits presumably will continue. There are numerous lawsuits in which Mr. Cronin has been named as a defendant, as well as many other NME entities. But if you really, Your Honor, want to focus on the harm to Mr. Cronin, you simply can't overlook the criminal proceeding. And I would urge the court to look closely at Mr. Cronin's affidavit and Mr. Carnes' affidavit with respect to that criminal proceeding, because this is not Mr. McNeil standing up and saying there's some possibility that his rights are being implicated. This is his lawyer, and this is he, who have spoken directly with federal agents and who know full well the imminence, if you will, of that proceeding.
Your point is that if they continue to prosecute all these entities without even suing Mr. Conan, that they might stumble across some sort of evidence that their investigation of this case will lead to the uncovering of evidence that could be used in a criminal prosecution of Mr. Conan. That's the sum total of your position on the harm to Conan.
Well,
their continued prosecution of the case might uncover something that will hurt Cronin.
That can't be all of my position, because if it's not they, it may be some other Cronin. My position is really flat.
But your position, but if they don't, they've done nothing adverse to Cronin.
Well, let me answer that in two parts, if I may, Your Honor. First, the answer is yes. The prosecution of this lawsuit, it seems to me necessarily is detrimental to Ron Cronin. Because this lawsuit is going to be, it's a lawsuit.
Well,
you're going to be calling people, and you're going to be asking them questions, and you're going to be trying to show that this organization, particularly within Texas, was corrupt.
And that assumes that by doing that, they uncover evidence that is detrimental to Mr. Cronin.
It assumes that that will be their attempt, and that goes into my second point, Your Honor. What business does a law firm have attempting to discredit a client? And I recognize it's a former client. Is that really where we want our legal profession to win?
Should the, when you're talking about the opponent being one party being able to disqualify the lawyers picked by the other party, when you're talking about that kind of step, where in the middle of hot litigation, in a complex litigation case, big law firms fighting each other, should we read adverse so broadly to encompass supposed thoughtful, maybe type harm to be a basis for saying I have the power to disqualify your lawyer?
Let me answer that in two parts. First is that, of course, these are large law firms, both of ours. This is important litigation. But, Your Honor, this motion was made at the outset of the litigation. This was not a motion that was made at some later point. But secondly, and perhaps more importantly, Your Honor, we have never seen that this is a broad reading of adversity. This is not the law firm of Baker and Botts filing some lawsuit in the psychiatric industry suggesting that the industry is somehow corrupt. This is not Baker Botts going to a legislator or an administrative position taking some position with respect to mental illness. This is a law firm that represented an individual who is now filing the civil equivalent to an indictment. And yes, they have chosen not to name Ron Cronin, but yes, they have chosen to name everyone around Ron Cronin. And how then can they possibly choose to, how could you possibly choose to discover and prove your lawsuit without proving that the CEO of the organization, was somehow clean when everyone else was corrupt?
Mr. McNeil, your contention is then that Baker and Botts cannot do anything to avoid adversity to Mr. Cronin as long as they remain in the case?
Absolutely.
And so a lawyer and a client can never agree confidentially among themselves to avoid a litigation strategy which would avoid the disqualification of that client's lawyer, if they chose to do that?
A lawyer and a client could not agree to do what, Your Honor?
To choose a litigation strategy. In other words, not to sue Mr. Cronin, if that was their decision, that would ultimately result in their disqualification if they pursued that suit. The client and the lawyer cannot agree to avoid a litigation strategy which would result in disqualification. Is that your position?
The client in that instance being Mr. Cronin and Baker and Botts, as opposed to the current client?
No, the patients
who
are suing NME and Baker Botts cannot agree among themselves to pursue, to avoid a litigation strategy which would clearly, perhaps more clearly than as you're arguing here, would result in their disqualification.
No, I think they could take that position. I mean, I think that agreement could be struck, whether it's an effective agreement, whether it could be carried out, but they can agree on anything they want. That, to me, Your Honor, is beside the point, because whatever agreement they've struck, the harm's done. And the harm was done when they filed this lawsuit. And the harm continues to be seen by the filing of additional lawsuits against these entities, including Mr. Cronin, and the ongoing criminal investigation. What can we imagine what federal agents and what federal prosecutors think today and thought then when Mr. Tomko was going in their offices and making representations with respect to Mr. Cronin and presumably making representations with respect to his innocence, and then finding that law firm that made those representations and now is out of that engagement, filing this lawsuit against NME, saying the very same thing that the prosecutors presumably would say if they were to file a criminal action. What are they saying?
If Mr. Cronin consented to the law firm representing the plaintiff in this lawsuit, would NME have any grounds at all for a motion to disqualify?
Yes.
And what would they do?
They would, and I would love to take the time to go in that. Your Honor, NME's rights in this are in some respects alongside Mr. Cronin's, but in some respects independent. As we have tried to set out in our brief, there is not one court in the country that we have found that has allowed a law firm in circumstances such as this to sue the NMEs. Every circuit court that we've been able to locate has said that in instances where there is a joint defense agreement, where there is the sharing of confidences, one law firm to that joint defense agreement cannot later attack a co-party to that agreement.
Do those joint defense agreements have the same type of language? I mean, is it clear from the face of the opinion? They have the same type of language this one does in terms of the rights of each individual party.
It is not. One does not know the answer to that because it is not clear from the face of the opinions whether there was a written joint defense agreement, and I'm generalizing. There may be a few cases, but as I remember reading the 2nd and the 5th and the 7th and the 8th and the 9th Circuit opinions, Your Honor, they didn't focus on a joint defense agreement as such. They didn't focus on whether it was written or whether it was oral. What they focused on was the fiduciary obligations that arise as a result of the sharing of information. And so whether they had before them, for example, in the Abraham case, we don't know. We don't know. The Fifth Circuit case, we don't know what the court had in front of it, whether it was a written joint defense agreement respecting Mr. Sussman or whether it was an oral joint defense agreement. If I may just button that point down, and I know my time is gone, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether they have provisions like this or not, because these provisions that the law firm of Baker & Botts is relying on, that provision that suggests that Mr. Tomko never became the lawyer for NME, that provision that suggests that Mr. Tomko has no duty of loyalty to NME, to suggest that now the firm of Baker & Botts can somehow take those provisions of that agreement that were intended to benefit their client Cronin and not a law firm in some separate independent action is a total corruption of that agreement.
How do you get around the express waiver of conflict of interest in paragraph 6?
Not an express waiver of a conflict of interest with respect to this circumstance. What that paragraph does, and the purpose of paragraph 6 in the joint defense agreement, is to ensure that Mr. Cronin, whomever else is a party to that agreement, can always be assured that their attorney, in this instance Mr. Tomko, will not somehow be conflicted out as a result of the information, the confidences that are shared. The concept of the joint defense agreement is that people are coming together in connection with a common purpose. That's 503b3 of the Texas Rules of Evidence. They're coming together to share information. And that information that's shared among them is confidential. And the situation that paragraph 6 is addressing is a situation where Mr. Cronin, at some later point, let's say, hypothetically, is indicted. And his attorney, Mr. Tomko, is alongside him. And Mr. Tomko, on his behalf, is looking to cross-examine someone whose confidences he obtained in the course of that joint defense arrangement. Let's say NME is on trial along with Mr. Tomko. The purpose of that provision of the joint defense agreement is to ensure that though Mr. Tomko received assurances and confidences, he is nevertheless able on behalf of Mr. Cronin to cross-examine NME. He can't use the confidences, but he can cross-examine. That conflict provision, neither by its terms, the concept, case law, could ever be expanded to give a law firm some rights independent of the client.
The trial court stated in connection with NME's motion to disqualify, quote, second and most striking, NME is not trying to protect against misuse of confidential information disclosed during the joint defense. Is that true?
That is not true.
So you're not merely relying on the presumption that would attend if there were an attorney-client relationship, but also on the actual misuse of confidential information.
Okay, let me make sure the court understands me. I have no evidence of misuse. And in fact, in this proceeding, I'm so stipulated, or I think I answered by way of interrogatory. But Your Honor, if I can try to button down that point, NME in that situation should be seen as no different than any client. And go back to the Henderson case decided by this court in the early court of 1995, when the question was asked of the complainant, can you show that those confidences were used by new law firm? Of course I can. Where this court said very clearly in a per curiam opinion, you don't have that burden. Never in Texas have we thought that you have the burden of showing the confidences are used because it's possible to show. And my point, Your Honor, is that NME, though not a client, of course, we're not suggesting that that is the case, but we are suggesting that the sharing of confidences, and I haven't had the opportunity, but those confidences aren't just routine confidences. Those confidences went to how you defend lawsuits such as this lawsuit. Mr. Tomko was made a part of our joint defense effort in the most comprehensive way imaginable. We talked with him about how you defend patient lawsuits. We shared our work product. We shared communication. Any other questions?
Thanks. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Judge.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Ronald L. Palmer will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, there are two separate motions to disqualify Baker Botts here in this case. First motion is by NME, which is not a client and admits they never have been a client. The second motion is by Mr. Cronin, a reluctant intervenor in this action. And each of these motions turn on a single basic issue, I think, that is different. Let me first address, if I may, Mr. Cronin's motion. And the court should note, because it is both curious and relevant, how Mr. Cronin came to be in this lawsuit. They describe Mr. Cronin as the CEO of a company. In truth and in fact, he moved to Texas, worked for 11 months as a mid-level executive in one of their subsidiaries. Shortly after getting here, got into a fight with NME, was fired after 11 months, and in connection with that firing, he represented, and this was at a time in 1991 when the investigations of NME were just beginning, he represented under oath to them at that time that in that 11 months that he was with them, he knew of no illegal conduct. He participated in no illegal conduct, and he had no information about any illegal conduct. And he signed that under penalty for perjury, and he also said, in connection with the dispute he had, which they made a settlement with him, that if I'm in error, if I'm lying, I give back the settlement. So we start back in 1991.
Excuse me.
He walks out the door. Excuse me.
When did this mid-level employee become the CEO or the regional director?
When did he?
Yes.
Yeah.
How long was he a Laurel Wood?
He was in this position for 11 months, Your Honor. He came in December.
He was promoted from.
He was moved from the East Coast.
He was promoted.
Higher
salary, higher responsibilities, a step up the ladder.
I don't know the answer to that because in the trial before, in the hearing before Judge Godbee, to paraphrase Judge Godbee, he says, you say this man is in the middle of this and he's involved. Do you even have a job description for his responsibility? and there was never one brought forth. All we know from the record is that he came from the East Coast, was here in this, had the term of the title regional director for 11 months, and at the end of that 11 months, or during that time, he got into a disagreement. He was fired. He made a claim against them. He threatened to sue them. They made a settlement with him, and as part of that settlement, as he walked out the door, he said, "I swear, I don't know anything about any wrongdoing." And that's the first issue, the first piece of evidence that Judge Godbee had before him. And the reason that I want to touch the highlights of the evidence that Judge Godbee had on this adversity issue is because it is totally different than has been represented, and it is compelling that we're not acting adverse. If I may,
Mr. Palmer, while you're doing that, do you consider this to be even a close case?
No, I do not. I don't consider this on the adversity issue that you're referring to.
Yes, sir.
I don't consider this to be a closed case, and the reason for that is I think that the authorities in this state and other states who have addressed that have suggested that on the issue of adversity in a rule such as 1.09, what is the best rule to have is a bright line rule, which suggests that adversity is judged by whether you're actually suing or bringing some sort of a judicial or quasi-judicial action against your client that has actual allegations directed against your former client. The only case that I know that is similar to the situation we have here is the case that, of McCarthy versus Henderson in New Jersey, which has a rule very similar to 1.09. And they had the argument made that a lawyer represents one closely held corporation. He later leaves that representation, represents a client suing a secondly closely held corporation that has the same officers and directors as the first. An effort was made to disqualify him, saying you're actually acting adverse to the first company. And New Jersey, after considering that, said we need a bright line rule here, and the first company is not a party, and therefore they're not adverse. The other reason that I don't think this is a close question is the argument that was made to Judge Godbee, which has been paraphrased somewhat here, was that there ought to be a rule promoted, as they say, that says any time a client's interest might be disadvantaged, potentially be disadvantaged, then the lawyer should be disqualified. First of all, there's no way that a lawyer such as I can know and monitor what my former client's interests are as they change through the years. I mean, for all we know, there was a lot of information provided to you outside the record. For all we know, the investigation has ceased.
How can you assure us that Mr. Cronin is not subject to potential criminal liability or prosecution?
The reason that I feel that the odds are that he is not is there are a number of reasons. First of all, he has always said, not just when Mr. Tomko represented him, but long before Mr. Tomko represented him, he's always said, "I was there 11 months and I don't know anything about what went on." Later, this lawsuit is really far down the line in a group of civil suits that have been filed against NME making the type of claims that we filed. There have been over 100 of these types of suits filed against NME in Texas. In those lawsuits, there have been more than 1,000 depositions taken by aggressive lawyers like Baker Botts and others representing the plaintiffs. One of the big thrusts of those efforts in those lawsuits was to identify who in the NME organization is responsible for this conspiracy and this fraud. There is not one single deposition, not one single lawyer in those civil suits that has ever turned over any information that indicates that Cronin has any responsibility at all for the allegations that we made and that they made, which were similar. And in fact, in Tarrant County, there were a group of NME employee suits sort of in a dragnet in some of these suits, including Mr. Cronin. Mr. Cronin was in every single one of them, was non-suited or dismissed. And it is stipulated in this case that Mr. Cronin has never had any judgment in any of these 100 suits taken against him, and he has yet to pay and has never paid a penny in settlement. The fact is that in all the lawsuits that are similar to ours with the discovery going on, there's not one set of lawyers has ever been able to pinpoint Mr. Cronin as being involved in the conspiracy.
Let me ask you this, though. Let's assume that there was some information that was conveyed from Mr. Cronin to his lawyer, Mr. Tomko, and that was potentially incriminating either on civil or criminal front information. You're really putting, aren't you, Mr. Cronin in a box, because he would have to come in and say, Mr. Tomko is in possession of information that, if revealed, could subject me to criminal liability or civil liability. And the only way that he could demonstrate that to the court and demonstrate the harm would be to reveal that information. Aren't we putting him in a very untenable position? You're saying no harm, no foul. He's got to show there's harm. We're putting him in a, aren't we putting him in a real box?
Well, I don't think the rule requires that showing, but 1.09 requires the showing that that my lawsuit is adverse somehow to Mr.
Well, again, Trump. For him to demonstrate adversity, aren't we requiring him to come in and say, Mr. Tomko is in possession of confidential information which, if disclosed, would subject me to potential criminal or civil liability?
I do not think we are. I think that there are many ways to get evidence of adversity rather than breaching what as you're suggesting, some client relationship. And in fact, the judge, God be found, and it is true that whatever confidences were ever exchanged between Cronin and Mr. Tomko, they are sacrosanct, and there has been no use, and there is no probability, never would be any use.
Getting back to the Henderson case, we held this year that if you have confidential information, you're not required to prove that there might be a disclosure. There's a presumption. How do you get around that presumption?
Well, that presumption is a presumption that applies in connection with establishing the substantial relationship. There are two requirements to disqualify the lawyer if a former client seeks to do it. The first thing he has to prove is a substantially related matter. And the presumption that you're referring to in the cases say that in order to show that the matters were substantially related, you don't necessarily, and you shouldn't have to come forward and give forth the confidences. There is no suggestion in judging the requirement of adversity that there's some presumption that matters are adverse and you don't have to prove it.
Is Mr. Cronin currently a defendant in any litigation involving these issues?
As far as I know, he's not in the record. And Mr. McNeil represented that some new cases have been filed someplace, but the record before Judge Godbee indicated that Mr. Cronin had never been a defendant in a criminal matter. He had never received a target letter from any investigative agency, and that in all the civil matters in which at one time he was named as a defendant, he was then non-suited or dismissed, and he has never paid a penny in settlement.
Has anyone paid money on his behalf in settlement?
As far as I know, they have not paid any money. He had a falling out with NME back in 1991 when they fired him, and has had separate counsel since, and NME stipulated in this on behalf of both themselves and Mr. Cronin that no money had been paid in settlement.
Getting back to the adversity issue,
yeah.
But my point is that he might be able to demonstrate that Baker Boss was in possession of information that would be adverse to his client, but in order for him to prove that adversity, he would have to reveal it. How do you get around that conundrum?
Well, I don't think that, I think that the way you get around it is, first of all, I don't think this court or any court has ever imposed some presumption in connection with adversity that said that is a matter that's subject to proof. And I think the way you get around it is that there are many ways to determine whether I'm acting adverse to Mr. Cronin or not without breaching that client, without breaching that privilege. I want to emphasize that the state of Texas investigated NME, and the purpose of their investigation was to find out who the principals were that were responsible for this fraud. There was 800 or 900 pages of testimony taken. Mr. Cronin is never even identified. There have been investigative articles written in some 200 or 300 newspapers about this fraud, including every major newspaper in Texas, and every there have been Newsweek, Wall Street Journal, New York Times. The thrust of almost all of these articles has been to identify who the principals, the ex-employees of NME were that were responsible for this fraud. Not one of those articles, not one, ever mentions this former mid-level executive who worked 11 months and got fired. He just doesn't appear. There's been a book written on the fraud that names more than 100 NME employees that were involved. Mr. Cronin's name never appears one time.
Yet the trial court found that there was some risk.
The trial court found that there was, that the risk was
minimal.
The trial court said that it's wrong to assume the prosecution of claims against NME and NME personnel other than Mr. Cronin inherently poses a significant risk to Cronin.
And yet if it materialized, it would be quite consequential.
Well,
that's what the trial court.
Well, I think that if it, you know, you can speculate. The facts are these. There is no indication that he is a target. Every indication is that everyone who has investigated the culpability has found that he has no culpability. And I'm convinced he has no culpability. We could speculate that tomorrow we might go and he would be indicted. We could speculate that tomorrow we might read in the Dallas Morning News that that the investigation ceased months ago. The other thing is that the court should take into account in trying to judge this potential criminal risk is the statute of limitations on the matters that NME was indicted and pled guilty to was expiring in 1994. Mr. Cronin never even worked at NME after 1991. There is no evidence that there's any investigation involving Cronin, and there wasn't any presented to Judge Godby. We can speculate that even if there was such, the statute it has expired or is about to expire. You know, Judge Godby, they made the argument, gosh, this is a big, massive investigation, and Judge Godby says, look, I see your chart, where's the, you know, can you tell me where the investigation is? When did it start? Who's involved in it? Who's already been caught in the net if there's a big investigation? The truth of the matter is there's not evidence that there's any ongoing investigation at all. And there's certainly not any evidence there's an ongoing investigation that would affect Mr. Cronin. Another piece of evidence that I know Judge Godby found persuasive on whether Cronin had any jeopardy at all was there were, in connection with the scheme that NME had, of course they built the insurance companies, and a group of insurance companies filed suit against NME, and the lawsuit papers are in the court's record. And those insurance companies pleaded, after considerable investigation, they pleaded specifically who was involved and how this scheme worked. And they set forth, I could give you names of the 30 NME employees that have been identified. But the point is, in some 100 pages of pleadings where they detail the scheme as part of their lawsuit, Ron Cronin's name never appears once.
Okay, Mr. Palmer, one of my concerns, it could be argued that the disciplinary rules are really absolute minimum conduct for which an attorney could be disciplined. In the context of disqualification, that maybe the court ought to give a broader reading saying that minimum conduct is not sufficient, that there ought to be a higher standard in the disqualification area. In that regard, adversity ought to be read more broadly than simply very narrowly, did you sue your former client? Arguably, in that context, you could say the lawsuit begins. We don't know what is transpiring over the years while all this is going on. We just now begin with the lawsuit, and what has happened is a former client was also a former partner in a partnership that's now being sued. And the former client comes in and says, that's potentially adverse to me because I was a partner with them during some portion of the time that's involved in the lawsuit.
So here's my former law firm that's suing a partnership that I was formerly a partner. Without knowing, I mean, we don't have the benefit of discovery to find out whether or not this former client had some sort of participation in what the wrongdoing is that's alleged. All we know is that the former client was a former partner with this partnership. But the argument that adversity ought to be read more broadly than that, wouldn't that encompass that circumstance and say that perhaps...
I think that there are some ways to read adversity more broadly than the bright line test that I have, that I said I think is the one that ought to be followed. And as far as I know, every jurisdiction that has been faced with this, and it's been precious few, I admit, have followed. In Judge Gottlieb's analysis, he said, if you don't look at the bright line test, you know, there may be circumstances where a former client is who is not a party, but you could still be acting adverse. And Judge Gottlieb, I think it's on page 8 of his order, he actually says, here are 5 factual inquiries that I will make, because as they did here, they urged, you ought to come up with something that covers a situation where you aren't suing the former client. And Judge Gottlieb did. And I think that he said he looked at the likelihood of detriment to the former client, and he analyzed each of these. And at the conclusion he reached, he said, under the evidence that was presented to me, applying this test, and this is on page 8 of his order, he said Baker Botts is not acting adverse. So Judge Gottlieb didn't apply the bright line test. I would just suggest to the court that I think that's the proper rule to be articulated. Judge Gottlieb challenged the lawyers. He says, suppose you wanted to come up with a single line test, and this is one that we proposed. Mr. Cronin's lawyer, he was represented by counsel in front of Judge Gottlieb, never was able to propose anything. If this court is interested in trying to articulate a rule that's other than if you're not suing the former client, there's some rule that could be applied to still determine adversity in that circumstance. I think this rule here is based on present facts. Does the representation currently create substantial risks of claims being asserted against the former client that otherwise would not be asserted? And Judge Gottlieb made a finding with regard to that test. So there, I think the reason I think the bright line rule is the rule is because it's already clear under our bar rules that you can act to the disadvantage of a former client. If you look at Rule 1.05, which is the rule that governs the lawyer's obligation to maintain former client competences, 1.05(3)(b)(3) says that a lawyer shall not knowingly use confidential information of a former client to the disadvantage of the former client after the representation is concluded, unless the former client consents after consultation or the confidential information has become generally known. This rule suggests to me that a lawyer is free, ethically free, to act to the, quote, disadvantage of his former client, and that doesn't rise to the level of being adverse under 1.09, and in fact, the rule says you can actually use the confidential information that you've gotten from this former client to his, quote, disadvantage if that confidential information has since become generally known. And that, so if you applied the rule that I guess they're espousing, that somehow you've got to look at the interest and you've got to sort of speculate as to what the interest might be, you really emasculate 1.05, and I think it's clear that whatever the definition of adversity is, it's got to be something more than the disadvantage which is permitted by 1.05.
Any other questions?
I want to ask about the joint defense agreement quickly. Is there any dispute that Baker Botts or Mr. Thompson was in possession of confidential information that came from NME that is not general knowledge or common knowledge?
For the purposes of this motion, we conceded that that, and told Judge Godbee he could assume that NME did share confidential information pursuant to the joint defense agreement with Mr. Tonka.
And that information is not now general knowledge or public knowledge?
And, yes.
Any other questions? Thank you, Jim.
Mr. McNeil, if adversity is a fact question, do you lose?
I'm sorry?
If adversity is a fact question, do you lose?
No, we don't, Your Honor. Adversity is a mixed question of law and fact.
Well, earlier you said there was adversity as a matter of law.
There are. There is.
In this case?
Under the facts of this case. Yeah.
But if it's a fact, if we conclude it's a fact question or a mixed question or whatever you want to call it, under which circumstances we would might otherwise defer to the trial court on an abuse of discretion standard, do you lose? If it's a factual matter.
I don't think I do. It's like any other proposition of law has to have certain factual underpinnings. Those factual underpinnings here are simply can't be disputed.
Well, if Judge Godbee decided those factual matters against you, should we defer to his discretion?
But he decided them on irrelevant factors, Your Honor. He decided them on irrelevant factors. He comprised a five-point formulation, and it makes no sense, with all respect. It looks to prejudice where the law of Texas is clear, that there can be no prejudice. It looks to whether confidences were shared, where the law of Texas is clear, that they will not answer that question. It looked to whether information that was within the attorney-client relationship was now within the public spectrum. That's irrelevant, Your Honor. It's just because the public might somehow learn of information doesn't forgive a law firm from taking an action that, again, is adverse to their client. So the answer is that I certainly have to concede that there are certain facts, but those facts are not in dispute, and the facts that he referred to are irrelevant to any proper rendition.
So Judge Godbee simply applied an incorrect legal standard, is what you're saying, and thereby abused his discretion under Walker versus Packer?
I would say that, and I would say that he also, in arriving at the ultimate conclusion of law, looked to irrelevant facts and did not properly consider the only relevant and uncontroversial facts.
Regards the joint defense agreement, your position is there's no evidence of misuse, but you don't have to prove misuse.
That is correct, Your Honor. And I get there for two reasons. The cases that I've seen throughout the circuits would suggest, talking about Wilson, Abraham case, the Trone case, and so on.
It seems to suggest that you would have proven misuse. That's what they remanded it for.
No. And Abraham, what they remanded it on, and this is an important issue, Your Honor, because NME in this setting and because Mr. Sussman in that other setting did not have an attorney-client relationship with the party sharing the information, that first presumption under Texas law doesn't kick in. There cannot be a presumption that confidences were shared in the joint defense arrangement. But once it's shown that confidences were shared, and that's clearly the case here, then that second presumption kicks in, which is that there need not be any showing. You ought not put that complainant to the burden of showing that those confidences were misused. Let me make a statement
in response to Judge Cronin's question that the court improperly use the facts to reach the legal conclusion, and I thought you said that he looked to only facts that were not controversial in reaching his decision. Is that what you said?
What I meant to say was that there are certain facts that one would have to find in order to reach an ultimate conclusion of law. I think he found those facts. There was an attorney-client relationship. There was a substantial, not identicality of issues, there was a sharing of confidences. I think, though, that when he went on to formulate his test of adversity, he looked to irrelevant facts.
Well, would you agree that there were controverted facts before the trial court vis-a-vis the adverse issue?
Not with respect to the only important issues. The only important issues I think the law would permit you to consider would be whether there was a substantial relationship between the two proceedings, whether there was a sharing of confidences, and then finally, of course, the ultimate question of whether this action can be seen as adverse. And
well, were there controverted facts about whether there was an adverse relationship in the record?
And Your Honor, to me, and I guess I've always felt this, the only important fact in that regard, and there are others undoubtedly pertinent, is the nature of that lawsuit. The nature of the lawsuit, the scope of the lawsuit, the position of Mr. Cronin, all of which is uncontroverted. There can't be any question about that.
Well, but what about on the other side of Mr. Cronin's termination agreement, which he said under oath that I did not participate in, did not know of, and did not conceal any unlawful or fraudulent conduct?
Yeah.
So isn't that a permissible inference that he has nothing to do with this litigation, and therefore that's why he's not a defendant?
Even if one could infer that, Your Honor, my position on that is that this law firm has no business setting out to make him out to be a liar. And that's what exactly this lawsuit does.
But their answer to that is we haven't done anything vis-a-vis Mr. Cronin yet.
Well, they haven't done anything at all because this lawsuit was shelved. But if you look currently at the discovery requests that were outstanding, and if you... I don't know how else to say this other than if we apply collectively our common sense to how a law firm would go about prosecuting a lawsuit that has the contours, that has the allegations of that lawsuit, there simply couldn't be any mistake that at some point in time, that lawsuit, whether purposefully or not, and I'm not suggesting that they're, whether purposefully or not, that lawsuit necessarily affects the rights of Mr. Cronin.
So there's nothing that Baker and Botts could do to avoid the adversity.
Correct.
I thought you told me earlier that a client and a lawyer could engage upon a purposeful litigation strategy that would avoid the necessity for that law firm's ultimate disqualification by choosing who to sue and who not to sue, what kinds of claims to bring and not.
What I meant to say to your question was that certainly a law firm and a client can agree on anything they want, but that agreement is irrelevant in this context because that lawsuit has already been filed and those allegations have already been made. And whether or not, it really doesn't matter whether in the course of this lawsuit, Baker and Botts goes out of its way to avoid discrediting or impeaching Mr. Cronin. The harm is done by the filing of the lawsuit. The harm is done by alleging that there was wholesale corruption within this organization. It is impossible, and this isn't speculation, it's impossible to think that in the course of the discovery, in the deposition program, that they're not going to be obtaining information that bears on Mr. Cronin's conduct.
So your answer is that it is theoretically possible, but here they've already made the allegations, they've gone too far?
Exactly.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first cause. The court will take a brief recess.
Yes.